This weekend starts right after this.
As a small business owner, you need protection for your physical and financial assets. From general and professional liability insurance to business owners and commercial auto policies, GEICO can help. Go to geicocommercial.com for your free quote and see how much you could save today.
From Compass Media Networks, this is America's First News. This weekend, with your host, Gordon Deal.
Resisting tech at the office. I'm Gordon Deal with Jennifer Koschenka. Thanks for spending part of your weekend with us. Here's what's coming up this hour.
The mix of early adapters and those who avoid the latest technology can make for an awkward work environment. We'll explain how to manage it.
The explosion of e-commerce has led to the repurposing of military bases, some of which have been closed for decades.
New apps that help you find temporary on-demand jobs.
And why are alligators being found in and around Pittsburgh, PA?
When I first saw a headline about the police finding an alligator by the Monongahela River, I just kind of shrugged my shoulders. You know, strange things happen every day. But then a couple weeks later, when they found another one, I thought this was quite surprising. And 2 days after that, when they found a third alligator in Pittsburgh, I started to think this is a story we need to investigate.
Wall Street Journal reporter James Haggerty on police having to fetch three gators off the streets lately. He's here later in the hour. More than 2 years after Donald Trump took the oath of office, many Americans find themselves not just taking sides, sometimes vehemently, but growing mentally anxious and exhausted. Don't worry. Among other things, there's an app for that. We're joined now by Ledge King, Washington correspondent at USA Today. Ledge, such a touchy subject for some people.
When I did the story about sort of the lingering angst between reds and blues in this country and efforts to approach it. I did get a few comments from people, but I also checked the comments on the story, and what I found was that the very thing I'm writing about, which is disagreement that borders on pure hostility, is very much alive in the comment section of the story I wrote about groups trying to douse some of that, at least bring civility back. So, yeah, it's out there.
You know, it was the one guy you quoted, or one of the people you quoted in the story. He said, you know what, I was that guy on Facebook. I was nasty, and I realize it now. That type of stuff, but that just seems to be, I don't know, an explosive device when you start posting on social media.
Well, social media has become this conduit for many things. It's not just sharing your vacation pictures on Facebook. It's also putting out your opinions about all sorts of things political. And it attracts people who are agreeing with you, and it attracts people who vehemently disagree with you. If you look at the Twitter feed for the president, you know, you get comments that are just effusively praising the president for being absolutely the best thing that's ever happened. And, of course, you get people who are absolutely convinced that the man is the devil. Mm-hmm. So there's not much middle ground.
What happened to the civility? I know this is a four-semester college course, I'm sure, but what do people say about that?
Well, you know, it's even the people that don't like Trump don't really blame at least the origin of the, you know, de-escalating political conversation in this country. What they say is that he's a manifestation of where we are. He adds gasoline to the fire, so to speak. But that this happened, you know, decades ago, really. I mean, one of the things I point out in the story is that 87% of Republicans approve of Trump's performance in 2018, while only 8% of Democrats did. And that 79% gap, the 79 percentage point gap, is the largest that's ever been recorded. But you know what? The second largest percentage gap was in 2016 under Barack Obama, a 77-point gap, the difference between the Democrats who liked Obama versus the Republicans who didn't like him was almost as big as the gulf that exists today. So, in his own way, Obama was a very polarizing figure in America as well.
We're speaking with Ledge King, USA Today, Washington correspondent. He's written a piece about the tough work of settling America's political differences. The University of Minnesota professor you talked to, a family social science professor, what was his take on this?
Yeah, Bill Doherty, really interesting guy. He talked about how he also runs, by the way, a project called Couples on the Brink at the University of Minnesota. So as I point out in the story, he's sort of seen the carnage up close. And he says that he started this group called Better Angels, and the point of the group is to not, in fact, convince people to change their views on politics. What it is designed is to get people together in a room calmly, as much as possible, talk about the other side's point of view, and try to get along. You know the old phrase, can we all just get along?
Yeah.
That's what they're trying to do. That's what Bill's trying to do. He's been a longtime family therapist, and he's talked to people who, you know, families that have split apart, essentially. He tells me, it's in the story, that there was an adult son living abroad who, upon finding out his mother and father voted for Trump, told him, you're no longer my parents.
Goodness.
And in another case, there was a wife who told her husband that she would divorce him if he voted for Trump. And what Bill said was that, to the wife, it was, you know, her husband was voting for Hitler. When passions run that deep, it's very hard to even hear each other. And Better Angels is not alone. There are other groups out there like the Bridge Alliance and Listen First Project and Living Room Conversations. And you can tell by their names that they're trying to at least soften the volume.
Thanks, Ledge. Ledge King, Washington correspondent at USA Today. 13 minutes now after the hour on This Weekend.
Michigan is one of the best places in the country to do business. But you don't have to take our word for it. Take Evan Lyles, CEO of Roush Enterprises, instead.
For the people that are involved in product development, there couldn't be more unique and exciting opportunities that are really going to shape the future of the world. It's a really exciting time to be in Michigan.
Big things are happening in business here. Find out why by searching Michigan Pure Opportunity.
Thanks for spending time with us. A new survey found half of women and 44% of men have had a work spouse, a colleague with whom you confide in about work problems, coworkers, personal issues. The numbers are from the job search engine Simply Hired. Is there a problem with having a work spouse? We're joined now by Keith Battle, relationship expert and pastoral counselor, also author of Side Chickology, Why Men and Women Cheat. Keith, define the work spouse.
So a work spouse is someone, obviously, that you have a professional connection with, you work together, but it's also somebody who you have a gender attraction to, somebody who you have a similar attraction to gender-based, and someone that you engage in conversations that are not just work-related with. Now, sometimes those relationships can be platonic and fun, you know, if they're public, but whenever they become secret and discreet, they're dangerous, and they're usually leading to more than just a work relationship. They're usually leading towards an affair.
All right, so you referenced something interesting there, and that's as long as this is public, meaning what? That everybody understands the relationship that you may have with this person?
Yeah, exactly. Sometimes it's just, you know, it's a couple of people who work together who, by and large, usually pick each other because there's no physical attraction or genuine attraction between the two of them. And so it's not going anywhere. It's the company joke. This is my wife, my work wife. This is my work husband. And as long as it stays jovial and public like that, it's usually safe. It's when those people start becoming secretive about their relationships or when it's not known, but it's a genuine, intimate relationship, that's when it's dangerous.
How long do these things, and I'm not talking about an affair, but how long before, generally speaking, you might call somebody a work spouse?
Again, if it's secretive, you never call somebody your work spouse publicly. But, you know, it depends on the environment. You know, a lot of the HR rules and boundaries now in the Me Too movement have kind of curtailed a lot of the jesting that happens between sexes now. However, there's still a high rate of infidelity that goes on at work. And I think, Gordon, that's the big issue here. It is the amount of infidelity that happens at work. partly because, one, you spend a lot of time with these people, which builds a level of trust. And there's a research, done out of Oregon State University in the late 1960s where they gave students pictures of faces. And after these students saw these, one set of students saw the same pictures 25 times. The other students saw it once or twice. And each time, in each scenario, the students that saw the same pictures more often became more attracted to the person. They liked the person. And just the exposure, repeated exposure to the same picture made people attracted to it. And the same thing happens in the work environment. When you spend regular time with somebody, you tend to be more attracted to them over time and trust taking a relationship further. And it happens a lot on business trips and in working relationships. It's epidemic.
We're speaking with Keith Battle, relationship expert and pastoral counselor, also author of a book called Side Chickology, Why Men and Women Cheat. And we're talking about work spouses. Other than the obvious, say, both parties dropping their pants, what are signs you've crossed the line? When are you heading down a dangerous path?
Well, signs in work, again, are discretion. When conversations tend to become more complimentary, physical compliments, and domestic complaints. Those two things right there, Gordon, are telltale signs. Whenever there are perpetual physical compliments and there are domestic complaints, when there's conversations about what's going on in my home and how unhappy I am in my marriage and what's going on in my sex life, once you cross that line, you're in trouble. The other thing that a spouse can look for in this situation, how does a spouse know? And I teach a lot of that in my book. How can a spouse know when their spouse is crossing the line, even at work? And one of them is they tend to be disconnected when they're around you. They tend to be obsessed with their cell phones. They tend to be absent and unavailable when they're not around you, inaccessible. And they tend to be very protective of laptops and iPads and other devices that you may want access to. Those are other signs that a person is probably involved in an inappropriate relationship.
Thanks, Keith. Keith Battle, relationship expert, pastoral counselor. Again, his book is called Side Chickology, Why Men and Women Cheat. 21 minutes after the hour on This Weekend. Time now for a business update, and it's brought to you by the Michigan Economic Development Corporation. The businesses of the future are being built today, and Michigan is where they start. Learn more by searching Michigan Pure Opportunity. Technological change in the workplace sparks tension between resistors who grumble and drag their feet and coworkers who rush to embrace new tools. What's it like in your office and how can you manage? Here's This Weekend's Jennifer Koshenka.
There seems to be one in every office, the person who refuses to learn new technology. But as Sue Schellenbarger, The Wall Street Journal, tells us, there are ways to reach the resistors and keep the office going. Sue, who are these holdouts?
Well, you may think that it's always the older workers. That isn't always the case. Sometimes young workers have their own issues with technology. They may think that the latest shiny new technology is better than what the office has. But generally, they're people who have trouble in some way figuring out how to use new gear, and they might have psychological obstacles. They might be afraid it will undermine their ability to do their job. They may not have had enough time to learn it, but there are generally some deep-seated reasons why people resist.
Sue, is it truly hard for certain types of people to learn new things if they're comfortable with the status quo?
It absolutely is. In some cases, people might be afraid of looking incompetent. They might think that their coworkers will look down on them or that they won't be able to do their jobs anymore. And this is really deeply threatening. And so people will do all kinds of sort of not constructive behaviors like avoiding using it. Some people even try to subvert it. There was some research a few years ago on doctors who were being forced to use electronic medical record systems. And some of them resented it so much that they actually sabotaged it by inputting too many prescriptions and causing it to crash.
Geez, so someone who refuses to go along or is unable to go along really could drag down the whole office.
This doesn't happen very often, but it does slow down technology adaptation. I talked to one law firm managing partner who really had trouble putting in a new platform. His His employees liked the old one. They were doing just fine, thank you. They didn't see the need for change, while he understood that their old platform was obsolete and it really wasn't going to work for them for very much longer. So it really can be an issue for a whole department.
We're speaking with Sue Schellenbarger of the Wall Street Journal. Sue, if you see a coworker who's struggling with new technology, what should you do?
As much as you might feel like, come on, get with the program, try to show empathy if you can. Because if you begin to criticize, this will just put that person more on the defensive. Understand that different people have different learning styles. Some people can learn from a video tutorial, while others really need to be using the technology with someone sitting beside them, step by step, to show them how it functions. And other people just need more time and maybe just to tinker with it without being under pressure. This is important to realize that for some people, being under time pressure makes it literally impossible for them to think clearly. So I think it's best to just back off, offer some alternative ways to learn, and try to support the person as they work their way through it.
And I would think that some of the resistors would say, why do I need to bother? The old system is working just fine.
Well, that's right. I think it's important to be able to show the benefits for that person on his or her job. In one case, an adaptation was going slowly, and a consultant who was brought in just had to sit down and show these customer service workers who were dragging their feet that, look, if you really learn this new technology, you'll have much more data available to you on your screen, and you'll be able to help the people who call in much more quickly. You have to be able to show them that there's some payoff for them individually, or they're just going to think it's some top-down order from the boss.
And I would say, speaking of bosses, Sue, that the manager or the boss should also be aware of the people who struggle and be able to help them individually.
Well, that's true, or to get them someone to help them individually. I think sometimes executives expect tech adaptations to go too quickly. They don't expect productivity to slow down, but research shows that it almost inevitably does, that you'll go through a few weeks even of reduced productivity while people get used to the new tools and begin to understand the advantages.
Sue, in your research, did you find that sometimes a new system is put in place and then it doesn't do what it's supposed to and a company will actually go back to the old way?
Oh, this certainly happens. I haven't seen companies go back to the old way. Generally, they have good reasons for adapting new technology, but they may have to adopt a revised program or maybe a different solution.
This weekend's Jennifer Koschenka with Wall Street Journal writer Sue Schellenbarger. 30 minutes after the hour. On This Weekend, thanks for spending time with us. Gordon Deal, Jennifer Koschenka, coming up this half hour, finding gigs quickly with your smartphone. Also, the spate of reptile escapes confounding Pittsburgh police, and a Missouri man's secret search for his wife's lost wedding ring in another country. That story in about 20 minutes. There's a new trend in commercial real estate. Developers are looking at abandoned military bases for large projects like warehouse and logistics centers, which are needed to sustain the growth in e-commerce. It's a story by Christine Negroni, freelance aviation writer who's got a piece in the New York Times. Christine, what have you found?
It is a tremendous, tremendous growth opportunity. And in the case of this military base in Arizona, they've realized that with the growth of e-commerce in America, where, of course, our expectation is I can order it this morning and have it this afternoon, what about all of our trade partners south of the border who, you know, being influenced by American media and American consuming habits, feel the same way? I'm living in Mexico City and I want to order something on Amazon. Why can't I have it tomorrow? And they don't. There are, you know, there's sometimes weeks of delays in getting things across the border. So the idea at this military base is to have a freight hub, an air freight hub, and get the customs conducted in the United States for Mexican products, so that once they leave Arizona, they arrive basically having already been accepted into the Mexican economy as trade goods that have already cleared customs. This is expected to save anywhere from 7 to 10 days if you're a consumer in Mexico. And of course, Mexico just starts the way to all of Latin America.
All right, so which bases are being targeted here?
Well, you know, the interesting thing about these bases, Gordon, this is kind of the light bulb moment is these bases weren't closed, you know, 2 weeks ago or 2 years ago. This particular base, Williams Base, was closed 25 years ago. The one in New Hampshire that I mentioned was closed in the 90s. So some of these were closed a long time ago, but they're not simple projects. It's not as if somebody, you know, like said to you, hey, Gordon, you know, we're not using this house anymore. Take it. It's yours. It would be if somebody said, hey, Gordon, we've got Rhode Island. You know, you can take it. You know, they're complicated. There's a lot of different infrastructure on the base. There's an airport in some of them. There's a harbor in some of them. And what do they do with that? Who owns them? Who pays for them? Who brings them back into use? Who gets rid of toxic and environmental hazards, of which, you know, sometimes they have them? So these were huge, huge, and I'm going to use air quotes when I say gifts. These were huge land transfers made to municipalities over the past 20, 30 years, and they're just beginning, I think, to get their legs, to start being something that has economic value in their state or in their areas. There's one in New Hampshire that's Pease Air Force Base, which now has an airport, an operating airport in it. It's got a harbor. It has a huge office complex where light industrial work goes on and office work goes on, and they have 10,000 employees. Wow. And I guess the nut graph of my story was when these bases closed in the 80s and the 90s, the community said, oh, my God, what are we going to do without these bases? We're, you know, our economy is going to take this big hit, right? Soldiers were leaving. Their families were leaving. Schools were closing. And now these bases that have become something else, or many somethings, are discovering that the economic benefit to their community is even greater than when the military was there.
Wow. We're speaking with Christine Negroni, freelance aviation writer for the New York Times. She's also got a book called The Crash Detectives. We're talking about her piece about how former military bases are being turned for use with e-commerce. So I'll make an assumption here. The likes of Amazon are interested in facilities like this?
Yes. The Amazons of the world, all of the eBays and all of everything's, you know, how so much stuff is coming to people right at their front doors, Fresh Market or whatever you call that one where they deliver groceries. But so much is coming out of the United States in terms of e-retailing that, you know, just people have different expectations about when they're going to get things.
Thanks, Christine. Christine Negroni, freelance aviation writer, contributing to the New York Times. 21 minutes now in front of the hour on this weekend. Americans are becoming more accustomed to immediate gratification and instant service in many ways, whether it's same-day package deliveries, food orders, quick money transfers, or hailing a ride. Why should finding a part-time job be much different? Russ Wiles, personal finance writer at the Arizona Republic, has a look at new apps that offer on-demand gigs. Russ, explain them.
There's a number of them out there. I kind of focused on two. One is called Wonolo, W-O-N-O-L-O, wonolo.com, and another one, instawork.com. These are two, coincidentally, some of their managers just happened to be launching the service in the Phoenix metro area, I think, recently, and I had a chance to talk to some of the executives as well as some of the, you know, part-time workers who are using the services, but there's others, and they tend to be rolling out nationally. What's kind of interesting, Wonolo, for example, has a broad range of jobs, different industries, but InstaWork, which I just referred to, is focusing only on hospitality jobs, you know, anything from maids to servers, bartenders, anything in the hotel or restaurant businesses. So some of the apps are focused, specialized on particular industries or other niches. Other ones are more broad.
We're speaking with Russ Wiles, personal finance columnist at the Arizona Republic, part of the USA Today network. And he's written a piece entitled, These People Found Gigs Fast. Here's how they did it using their smartphones. And he's touched on a couple of apps. One is called Wonolo, and the other one is called InstaWork. Generally speaking, are these folks who are just cobbling together, say, full-time hours with a number of part-time gigs, or are these folks with full-time gigs who are just picking up a few extra bucks?
Well, both. I mean, as you know, a lot of people are underemployed or they're maybe working a full week, and yet they still need extra cash for whatever reason. They might pick up a Saturday shift, for example. On the other hand, there are a lot of people who are working part-time jobs and like to do that. They don't want to, you know, set 9-to-5, 5-day-a-week schedule. So it could work for both of them. It could be feasible for someone like a teacher who has a full-time job 9 months of the year and then is out for the summer. There, it could be something that of interest to a retiree who just really probably isn't even so focused on the money as just doing something, 1 or 2 days a week. So the applications are quite broad, and you see people from, full-time, cobbling together, as you said, a full-time weekly schedule to those who might just want to work a shift or two a month.
How do you get paid?
It depends on the service, but some of these services pay you through through the app, usually with a tie into your bank account, and payment, from what I understand, is fairly quickly. You're not waiting 2 weeks for a paycheck. You're often being paid within 24 to 48 hours, which is another trend that's been proliferating lately, too. Almost instantaneous pay for work, but that's another story.
And the business model here is what? You are an employer, and you go to InstaWork and post it. InstaWork may take a piece of the action, ultimately?
Yeah, good question. The employers are typically paying to... like they would with if they were working with through a temp agency or whatever. They are paying the app services for the help of connecting with an employer. So yes, they would pay after a shift is completed. They would pay, say, Wonolo or InstaWork, and that company would remit the payment along to the actual worker.
And are you vetted in some way, shape, or form if you're giving your info to these apps?
Yeah, I mean, to some degree. I mean, it's not as rigorous as sending in your resume and everything. But some of them, yeah, I think most of them actually would check citizen status, for example, and certainly they'd do a background check. But it's not as formal as a lot of us are used to in terms of job searching, which might involve 3 referrals. Sitting down for a formal resume, formal interviews. Sometimes you hit the app and you show up at work, 2 hours later or a day later, and there's no intervening interview in the process.
How about that? Thanks, Russ. Russ Wiles, personal finance writer at the Arizona Republic. 13 minutes now in front of the hour on this weekend.
Michigan is one of the best places in the country to do business, but you don't have to take our word for it. Take Petty Poppy's, president and CEO of Consumers Energy, instead.
All of the innovation that's occurring around robotics, AI, it's happening here in Michigan. We have chemical companies, we have pharmaceutical companies, we have medical device manufacturers. Michigan is a magnet for innovators and dreamers.
Big things are happening in business here. Find out why by searching Michigan Pure Opportunity.
Glad you could spend some time with us. After multiple incidents of alligators roaming freely in and around the Pittsburgh area, police are asking for people to pay more attention to the whereabouts of their reptiles. More from James Haggerty, reporter at the Wall Street Journal. He's based in Pittsburgh. James, what's going on in your city?
Well, that's a good question. When I first saw a headline about the police finding an alligator by the Monongahela River, I just kind of shrugged my shoulders. Strange things happen every day. But then a couple weeks later, when they found another one, I thought this was quite surprising. And 2 days after that, when they found a third alligator in Pittsburgh, I started to think this is a story we need to investigate.
I thought it was funny you pointed out it's not likely that the gators are migrating over the Appalachians and into southwestern Pennsylvania.
That was my first thought. Yeah, I mean, could this be global warming or something?
Right. So what's happening?
Well, the theory of the police is that these are alligators who were pets, and people either they escaped or people just let them loose because they were tired of buying all that food for them. Alligators grow pretty fast, about 12 inches a year, I understand.
Oh, wow. All right, so one you referenced was about 3 feet or so. Another one was 5, which starts to raise eyebrows. But one of them was close to 12 feet, right?
Well, not in Pittsburgh, but that could happen. Yeah, in another city, yeah. I think an 11 or 12-footer was found a few years ago in a driveway. Mm. So if you woke up to that, that would be... That could be bad for your heart.
I thought it was interesting. The one guy who kind of fessed up and said, yes, it's mine, he had kind of the full spectrum of reaction from neighbors. The one guy said, "Yeah, hey, listen, that thing's a menace." And the other guy said, it's harmless.
Yeah, I think opinions are mixed on it. One of his neighbors thought that the gators were very well behaved. Yeah. But another one was out walking his pit bull, and he said he didn't think gators should be wandering around because they were dangerous to pets. And I asked him if, you know, his pit bull was 90 pounds. I figured the pit bull could take care of itself. And he said, yeah, I probably could, but he didn't really want to see that fight. And if you had a chihuahua or something, it would not really be a contest.
Right. We're speaking with James Haggerty at the Wall Street Journal. He's written a clever piece entitled, "We Don't Need Alligators in Pittsburgh. Spate of Reptile Escapes Confounds Police." So Western Pennsylvania, right? It's typically a cold weather area. How do police there handle reptiles that we normally associate with warm weather states like Florida or Louisiana?
Well, very carefully. They didn't have much experience. They got the poles out that you use to catch dogs, a little pole with a hook at the end or a loop at the end. And they used duct tape to hold the gator's mouth shut. And I sent a video of this down to an alligator rescuer in Phoenix, and he told me that it was a textbook operation. He thought they did an excellent job.
Thanks, James. James Haggerty, reporter at the Wall Street Journal based in Pittsburgh. 6 minutes now in front of the hour. On this weekend, not many guys could lie to their wives about where they're going, leave the country, and then come back as a hero. But a Missouri man did. Drew Husky of Wildwood in St. Louis County was on vacation with his wife, Emily, in Canada. Not long after they were married, her wedding ring slid off her finger during a restroom stop on a long drive and landed in about 2 feet of snow. It's worth about 10 grand. That happened in October of last year. They searched for 3 frigid hours, couldn't find it. Mr. Husky made a vow to return to the area between Banff and Jasper National Parks and find the stone. So he did some research, found that the snow would mostly be melted by the end of May. He contacted a metal detector expert who agreed to help. Mr. Husky told his wife he was going on a fishing trip to Montana with his son and kept the recovery mission a secret. After 2 hours of searching, they found the ring. When he re-presented the ring to Emily, she cried for about an hour, he says, and then he fessed up to his whole concoction. She now, by the way, uses sizing beads to keep the ring from sliding off. For Jennifer Koschenka, I'm Gordon Deal. Thanks for listening to This Weekend. As a small business owner, you need protection for your physical and financial assets. From general and professional liability insurance to business owners and commercial auto policies, GEICO can help. Go to geicocommercial.com for your free quote and see how much you could save today.